You're listening to the Intentional Partnerships podcast, where we explore what it looks like to truly engage families for the benefit of children. Lindsay and I have a great opportunity this afternoon to talk to Renee Butler. And Renee comes to us out of Oklahoma, and we're really excited about the work she's presently doing and the things that we're going to be talking about today. So Renee, tell us about yourself. Tell us about your work presently.
Okay, the work that I'm doing presently is looking at intergenerational transmission of trauma. It's tied to my doctoral program. I'm a doc candidate, so I'm not quite finished yet. And I decided to look at that work because there was an epidemic of brown and black boys being suspended at 3 and 4 year old in pre-kindergarten, early childhood programs. And I decided I wanted to look at that and see what it was about.
Awesome. In our work with early childhood programs and Head Start programs, you know, behavior is an issue. And at the same time, like you said, the way that it's dealt with is definitely an issue. And we're glad you're here to talk to us. So talk to us about your work. We are talking about family engagement and how in these educational settings, we're engaging families. What has been your history as far as that work in education in various entities?
I think it was nice for you to talk a little bit about early childhood and behavior, because I think that when we start looking at family engagement, the child is not engaged. Well, actually, I think that there's two pieces to that. There's the parent-child, and then there's the family program. So they have kind of sort of the same focus in terms of how we engage relationally. That's a huge piece. And I come by that work, of course, by doing some consult and some work in early childhood programs, but the majority of it in a public school district.
Can you expand a little bit more on that concept of that there's two ways to look at engagement? Because I think that's really important, is that we're not just talking about family program, although that's a huge piece of it. There is this other piece of parent-child, and kind of how you see those two things related and similarities that you see or differences, or just expand on that a little bit more.
Okay, so when we talk about, again, how I come to this work, I am a social worker. So the way that social workers engage is with the client through its environment. And so when you're looking at the parent-child and then you're looking at the family program, if what we want to do is get that maximum learning and help them feel safe in their environment, then there's, and we understand that the first teacher is the parent, then we have to also stretch to understand that the first teacher is also the program.
When we talk about the program, so for the benefit of the child, these programs that I think we all support, and parents as teachers, and Head Start, early Head Start, and different things, as they reach out to families, they want to help the family, but a lot of times I see, and I think it's kind of what you're talking about, there's also a disconnect between helping the family kind of deal with some things, maybe some outside challenges that have a direct impact on the child's behavior. But do you find that sometimes they're separating the child's behavior in those issues from their work directly with that family and how they deal with the behavior in the classroom and then the parent, as opposed to the way they're engaging the family maybe in different ways in that program?
Certainly. I think you're exactly right. The challenge for me as a social worker being in those particular settings, and it took a minute for me to kind of figure it out because, of course, you know, social work is across the lifespan. But as I started to engage in the public school system, that's part of what pushed me to go back to school, because I couldn't quite understand being in the educational system and the disconnect between the child that's in the school and the family that we kind of sort of sit somewhere over here. So when you get the call as a social worker and you're in the school building and you've got a 3 or 4 year old who is acting out or whose behavior is challenging to the school district and the school room, then you have to go in there and do some observation and kind of figure out what's going on. And you're exactly right, Mike, that there is that disconnect. So I started trying to figure out how you help teachers be okay in the moment, and then how you move to helping the family engage in that system. One of the ways in which I started to think about that, we begin in early childhood programs by welcoming children and families into the building. So if I have and we have children going into a daycare and those kinds of things much earlier than we used to. But back to, I digress just a little bit, but going back to looking at how that child is welcomed into an early childhood program is just a little bit different than how they're welcomed into school buildings. So within an early childhood program, be it a Head Start program, be it an in-home program, the child and the family, the whole family is welcome. But somewhere around that 3 and 4, when we're trying to get children ready for public school, we start disconnecting. They're no longer welcome the same way.
Right.
And so then now we're looking at that developmental piece for 3 and 4 year olds who are kind of hardwired to pay attention to those kinds of things from a family perspective. So if it's not safe for my family, it's not going to be safe for me. And so we start to have some challenges with behavior. And then the school system doesn't quite know how to go back and reengage that welcoming piece. So all of those things right there that I have been observing sent me back to school to try to figure out.
And so have you figured it out yet?
That's a great, that's like, okay, so tell us.
No, but I think all of those things are really interesting. And when you think about, you know, this separation of family and school, I think you're absolutely right. We see that all the time. Is that's kind of this bridge that family engagement work is trying to do now, is to create, you know, how do we reach back out to the families that have had some walls put up? And in your work with schools or early childhood or things, think about our work with families through this lens of compassion is kind of what we wanted to look through today. And so having empathy and thinking through families. And have you seen those conversations happen at schools and in early childhood centers that have really kind of focused back around the families and thinking about their situations and their experiences with schools at all? Or how have you seen those conversations happen?
Okay, so one of the things I think that is happening, I think that we are finally in the know or in real time understanding that we have to go back and do some work. And so while I was at the Casey Family Programs, what they would say is, where are we going to get our biggest bang for our buck? And I think that we finally figured out that the way that we do that is we have to start at the early learners stage, you know, that 3, 4, 5 year old. And when you ask, had I figured out a solution yet? Not quite. But I think that one of the solutions is definitely being authentic. So those of us who are what the People's Institute calls gatekeepers, those of us who are gatekeepers, then we have to get really real with ourselves and figure out how we can be authentic so that we can allow the people who we are serving to become the same way. Because the only way for us to help a family engage is if they let us. But if I've already made some decisions about how they should engage with me, then I am not giving them permission to come with what they have to offer.
And so you mentioned something earlier, and you know, I have public school background, and what we've seen in the past is kids coming out of really strong early childhood programs, and the family has been engaged, whether through home visiting or I say the intensity of Head Start or early Head Start. And then we talk about they hit that wall in the public school. And to me, there's a couple of things going on. I'd love to hear your response to this. Is I think it was so interesting that you mentioned that child doesn't feel safe or doesn't feel his or her family is safe. Like they, and like I said, they pick up on that real quick. You're separating from me, from my family. You're treating my family a different way. I'm not real cool with even being here. And then the other thing is that protection that goes into public schools, because we get to where we're afraid to say things or we're afraid of the conflict. So we don't have authentic conversations. And then nobody trusts anybody. And under this realm of compassion, how can people go in and help teachers deal with kids that are coming from trauma and yet bring that family in with some empathy and compassion and yet kind of keep some of those parameters? And I don't think that the parameter of silence or being stoic and not really talking to a parent is good, but that's what we tend to do. So what are some ways practitioners can bring those two together where we're showing compassion to the child that's dealing with these things and the family that wants them in this program, and yet the school has to deal with both of those? And I think that's where we don't do a good job.
I come by this work because of some of my own trauma issues. And I think that one of the things that we forget in the public school system is we forget about the institutions in the United States were not developed or not invented to invite Black and brown people in. They were developed to keep us out. So we have to go back and kind of do that work so that once we have the child in there, we believe, I'm talking about us as a gatekeeper, and I've become a gatekeeper as well. So I'm kind of like on both sides of the fence, and sometimes it just boggles my mind that I come from a place culturally where we've had historical trauma, and then now I have joined the people who help figure out those things and help everybody be okay in a certain system. I think that we have to remember that even people who are impoverished, oppressed, who have slave legacy, historical trauma, that they have knowledge to bring to the table as well. So then when you start looking at that, we have to figure out what that language is between us and them and make some kind of way. And I'm not sure what that is because different systems have to do different things. We have to make some kind of way that we can all get on the same page in terms of language and how we view culture. If I am a gatekeeper, it is incumbent upon me to help the client or the person that I'm working with to understand what it is that I understand about the system. But it is equally as incumbent upon me to stretch myself to understand whatever the language is that they're bringing to the table and the cultural piece that they're bringing to the table, so that we can figure out how to get on the same page. And then it is at that point that we have some kind of synergy that we can work towards the engagement and keep them at the table.
I think it's a really interesting the idea that you just brought up, that we think about this idea of us and them often as professionals and families, but forgetting that a lot of times us and them can be the same people. We are professionals and we are like parents at the same time. You just said you're coming from kind of both lenses. And I think that's a really important thing to think about as professionals who are working with families and sometimes can get away from, you know, we have to recognize how closely we all are related in this. And it's not an us and them. It's a we as people who want the best for kids. Like, how do we all get on the same page?
Right. And if we're going to do that, we have to be aware and we have to be willing to fully engage in shared knowledge.
That is a very critical distinction of aware and willing are two very different things. And I think that's where we get stuck sometimes. Everyone's kind of aware of what's going on, but who's willing to take that step to move towards the compromise or to move towards to have those really deep, raw, real conversations that we have about what is holding people back from accepting the knowledge that's out there or acknowledging the knowledge that's out there in all of its forms.
Wow. Awareness is a huge piece of authenticity. And so when you become aware of that or if you engage with yourself, then I think you're better equipped to engage parents. Because if you're engaged with self and you're aware, then you're pretty reflective or you attempt to be reflective. And you allow some space, one, for you to make some mistakes and then come back to that. Again, it's reflective, but then it also puts you in a modeling place, you know, so that you can model for the family that you're engaging with how to do some of that and how to, I must say it this way because I right at this moment I can't figure out another way to say it, but allow the family to check me when I'm coloring outside the line.
Well, and help me part this out, because we're talking about, like you say, you've got a family coming from trauma, generational situation, environmental, there's all these different issues coming in. You've got folks that are coming in at a professional angle and sometimes believe they understand when they may or may not. And even if they do understand, getting the right words and tone and that going back to that compassion of getting that family to understand that we're here to help this child, and yet we've got some issues, and then the family coming from both the trauma and the biases that we're talking about. You know, and the biases, when I begin to talk about biases, sometimes people will say, you know, they'll assume I'm talking about Anglo school leaders or, you know, white principals, counselors, and teachers. And I also find that among professionals, African-American professionals sometimes really struggle with understanding that trauma, because they may have gone through it as a child and don't understand why this is going on with this family, or they may not have seen that even though the skin color is the same. And so how do you help families and professionals kind of develop that conversation where we can kind of stop looking at each other sideways? It's so hard because a family comes in, they have a child that misbehaves, and all these assumptions come into play around that child's behavior. And then when the school addresses it, all these assumptions come into play from the families and how they've been treated, or even if we're trying to do our best to treat them well, it's going to look like in so many ways, because it's an institution, it's going to reflect other ways they've been treated poorly from other institutions. And so where's our groundwork? Where do we lay our foundation? Because you mentioned welcoming, that's more than welcome. That's more than a handshake. So where do we lay that foundation?
So it is more than a handshake. And one of the ways that I think I figured out how to do that in an early childhood program is that if I can get everybody on board to understand that we are not in a place where every child, that there is just a handful or a couple of children who are experiencing trauma.
Right.
I believe we are in a period and in a time where that is more the norm than not, that a good majority of the children that we serve are experiencing or come from trauma background. And then if you're talking about an African-American person who has some latent historical trauma, who has not been given the permission to talk about that. So in the work that I'm doing, one of the things that I figured out is that it's okay for its generational trauma to be talked about from Jewish people. And it's okay for a historical trauma to be talked about from Native people. But it has not been okay for African-American people to talk about that at all. So the work that I'm looking at, and this is down the road where I can even get to where I can do the collect the data information on this, because I'm now assessing the tool. But I believe that, or my hypothesis is that transmission is disassociative. So it's not even conscious, worded, or developed to even be able to talk about it. So that's one piece of it. We have lots of literature that talks about teacher bias. We get that. What we haven't figured out, I think, is how we bring them those two together. And I think whoever is working with whomever, be it in the home, be it in the early childhood program, we have to be aware that we have to help everybody. It's almost like conducting a choir, if you will, because you've got the system of teachers, the system of children, the system of families, the system of administrators, the systems of educators. You know, it's all the Bronfenbrenner stuff, but with some extra overlay that has to be 3D, if you will, that I have to understand that the majority of the children that I am serving come to this place with trauma. And if my children have trauma, the children that we are taking care of, I can only guess where they got it from, especially if parents are the first teachers. So then we have to back up and figure out how we come at that work. But in addition to that, what Lindsay said about us and them, then if I'm going to consult and help this community figure out how we do the best service, then I have to be aware that a good portion of my teachers who are instructing these children, forget the biases piece, where's their trauma stuff at? And how often is it being triggered?
Right. Well, and particularly with the child, you know, really challenging behaviors, we're not talking about the occasional defiance and good professionals that understand 3 and 4 year olds are having bad times and bad days. But these are kids, I mean, and it runs the gamut. When you talk about the trauma that a teacher goes through or comes from, that's a very interesting concept to think about. The trauma of we never talk about conflict or I came from a ton of conflict also comes into play. You know, so I've got this child in my classroom that's causing some conflict at whatever level, and I either have been through lots or kind of never learned how to deal with any of it. You know, I know there's, and that's the whole spectrum, and there's a bunch in the middle. And then just to have a parent that's in conflict because they want their child in a program, they're trying to figure out what's going on with their child, and they've asked for help. And now the people they've asked for help are telling them, you know, perhaps they can't help. What do you find when you deal with these families that are dealing multiple levels of trauma, and now they've got a child dealing with this in an institution, because that's the best ones are still institutions. What are the families doing, or what do the families possess that are coping with this better? Or what are the pieces that come into play so we can start looking at, again, not only discussing those, but kind of uncovering those and maybe even, you know, laying them out for everybody to use?
I think we have to remember that we are a professional learning community. Probably remember that this is not a solo gig. It takes you, it takes Lindsay, it takes me, it takes the parent, it takes the grandparent, and it takes the teacher and possibly the assistant teacher that's in the classroom to sit down and come up with some kind of plan that can help us serve this child in the best way that our particular program can do that. And I have to be honest that sometimes the program is not the best place for it, you know, that we may have to look at something different. But we have to be willing to be honest about that and say it. And not, I don't know, maybe not feel like we're failing, because I know that that is a part of it, because I should know how to do this. And sometimes we don't. And sometimes we have to just be willing to kind of stay in there until the fix it, if you will, shows up.
Have you, in your all of your work with schools and early childhood centers, and you talk, like we've talked a lot about, you know, the need for these conversations and the need to address some of these things, but have you seen schools or centers try to dig in deep with some of these things, and kind of how are they doing that?
Definitely, I've seen them. This is a whole piece, you know, when you're going through a DOC program, you guys, I'm probably speaking to the choir, but when you're going through a DOC program, there are some things you just kind of have to put aside. My advisor, my chair, wonderful woman, Dr. Lake, says to me, that's an article for another time. Put that in an envelope and put it away. That's really fabulous. She kind of keeps me on the straight and narrow because you guys don't know this about me, but I have some learning disabilities too, so I can kind of spin a circle, right? And it's like, let's stay linear about this. But one of the circles that started to spin as I tried to work with teachers to help them to understand that particular system that we were in was saturated with children who were experiencing trauma. And what I found was is that as much as we talk about integration, our system is still struggling to be there. So I have the thought that even though we give voice to integration of things like the teachers with the administrators, with the families, and engagement, which is what we're talking about, that all of those things are kind of siloed when it really is time for it to move through that piece of chain. And we haven't figured out how to break out of those silos yet.
Well, and do you find, because you talk about that integration, and then the idea there's segregation through geography in our schools, there's segregation through economics. And then when we're talking about, you know, again, going back to your work with behavior, you also see those kids being segregated into specific classes or in certain or specific circumstances. Not for the best education of that child as much as they can't, you talked about it, they're expelling these children at 3 and 4 years of age. Do you find that there are some champions at the administrative level? There are some champions in the classroom. There are some champions that there are families showing this perseverance, showing these certain skills that, you know, of advocacy, you know, I'm not going to get bent out. I'm going to do my job as a parent. But what are you seeing in those things? And what do these champions look like? Because, like you said, the situation is not even good for these kids. So we've got to go to those individuals and find out, what do we emulate? You know, what do we begin to look? Because, as you said, we spin in circles about so many conversations, but who's getting it done? Or what are the things that are working? So we can begin to look at those.
Most of the families who are self-determined, even if they don't have the answer, even if they come with lots and lots of questions, and I think that Duckworth would call it grit.
Right.
Those are the ones that have that resiliency. And it looks real different for all kinds of people. I think that sometimes is education and information, resources available sometimes, and sometimes it's just temperament. You know, that family has a different temperament, so they can roll with this, they can hear the hard stuff, and then they can keep moving. And I think that administrators, definitely, there are some that are in it. I mean, I don't think that anybody does this work and not want to be good at it and not want to provide a really good place for children and families to be. So we stay in it, and we continue to try to figure out what those answers are. So I think all of those things that I aforementioned, as well as keep looking at and searching for the answer and asking questions. And then remember that if I'm a gatekeeper, you're a gatekeeper, Lindsay's a gatekeeper, that we make sure we man those gates so that they flow pretty evenly in and out.
I like that you just turned the idea of gatekeeper on its head, because I think a lot of times when we think about gatekeepers, we think about those people who are there to keep people out. But I love the idea of being a gatekeeper is our job is not to keep people out, but it's to make sure that everyone gets through that gate in a way that doesn't trample other people or stop other people from getting through in a way. So I love that way to think about it.
Right. I agree with that. I probably can't say it much better than you said it, Lindy. And that is exactly what we're supposed to do, because when you talk about gatekeeping, historically it's looked at as how you hold people out. But when we come from, when those of us who are keeping the gate come from some of the communities that we're assisting, it is incumbent upon us that we help those gates come in and out. But again, that requires some authenticity, and it requires some self-awareness. So then when you start talking about people who come from oppressed communities, then we have to dig really deep to talk about what those internalized oppression things are. Can we identify them? Am I behaving counter to what I should be if I'm serving in an early Head Start program or I'm serving in an in-home program? What kinds of things do I need to be looking for, and what kinds of things do I need to do to check myself as I'm going out to serve? Who do I have in the office, in my community, in my multidisciplinary team who can hold me accountable for being earnest and making sure, yes, the gates go both ways?
Let me ask you to respond to this, because I think there's two things when we talk about recognizing trauma. And it goes along the lines of our topic here on compassion. I think you could talk to a lot of professionals, and at that surface level, most of them would understand and appreciate that these families with a kid that is a challenge or not, but they see these families and they understand these families are coming from trauma. Sometimes they don't understand it's through oppression. They don't understand it's solely because of culture or skin color and all the other things that go with that. But they'll kind of agree, yeah, there was trauma. But if we go to that next level, you have people that want to know how to work with or deal with families coming from trauma. And then you have professionals of all cultures and colors that will kind of dismiss the child and their behavior because of the trauma. In other words, they almost feel like, well, you know, they come from this situation. And so what are we to do? So the question is, what do we say? What do we do to move people along, to get that aha? And I mean, maybe to bring about to bring about repentance, to have a revival in these folks where it's like, okay, we all understand. We can all speak at a professional level about trauma, but do you have the hope and the tools to deal with it so that it is not the end result? It is not the sentence for this child just because they come from trauma. You know, I think when you talk about trauma, they're like, oh yeah, we get it. Okay, but are you willing to work through it and deal with it? So what do we say? What do we say to professionals about, okay, so you see it, how do you get them to move towards that?
Okay, so again, we're talking about a professional learning community. I have to kind of remember that when I'm the social worker in the building, then I'm kind of like this coordinator of site of, if you will, of healing. If the person that's doing the work isn't getting it, then you're right. We have to figure out what do we do to help them get it. But it's almost sometimes to a body sense. So, you know, that whole thing around you do better when you know better. So the thing is to get them to figure out and help them to understand how to know better. So there is a tool that started to work wonders for me and trying to help people understand this, and that's that functional behavior assessment for children. And so in an early childhood program, because you have so many children, and because a good portion of them come with quite a bit of stuff, if you will, then you start getting the teacher to count how many times this thing happens. So is it really a problem, or is it just annoying? And if you can help teachers and even families to figure that piece out, then I can get a little bit more bang for my buck, if you will. I can get them to buy in, to kind of hang on, so that we can do a little bit more work down the road. But you all, and I'm talking about the person that's kind of orchestrating, but you have to come at this with this whole kind of spirit of, I get to do this. Because after you've been doing it for a while, it's kind of easy to get burnt out and have all of these, this kind of negative kind of things to bring to the table. And I'm no different than the next man. I can get that way as well. But I have to go back as I'm doing my self-awareness, my self-care, and a reflection of why I do what I do, I have to remember that I get to do this. I chose to serve. And that, again, is wonderful. A person, Dr. Cromer from Tulsa University, helped me to figure that out. Because I mean, I was moaning and groaning, and as she calls it, self-defecating. Just in a really kind of place like, oh my God, I don't even know why I chose to do this. And it's like, but you get to do this. Sometimes if you can help people just even move to that idea, and sometimes that means we have to tell our own story so that we become transparent. They can see that I didn't just arrive at this place. There was some work that had to happen, and I get to do this. You can get them to kind of catch that spirit, then we might be able to move this along a little bit longer until we figure out the answer to the real challenge that we're dealing with.
Well, I know we're kind of wrapping up on time here. Renee, is there anything that you want to make sure that we cover that we didn't today? I mean, I think this is a wonderful conversation. So, but I just want to make sure there's nothing that you want to make sure that we get out into the world.
We are a family system, and we have to remember that it's layered. And if we can at all, remember to make the work that we do with families purposeful, make it communicative, and remember that the intent is developing and defining what family engagement is. And sometimes that means we have to ask questions so that we can continue to add on to what that means. I guess what I'm really saying is that progressive and understand that families want understanding, and we have to look at this child within a family context. There's no way to look at children by themselves.
I think that beautifully sums up why we even talk about family engagement at all, because ultimately we're all here for the betterment of children, right? And to get there, we have to work with families too, because kids go as far as their families can take them. And we want all of everyone to be moving together.
Lizzie, we may have to say that over and over and over and over and then over again.
Well, the good part is we're going to get the word out to all those that had the blessing of listening to this today. And guess what? It can actually be played over and over and over. And I hope that our listeners will. And we're going to promote it. And we appreciate your time so much. We appreciate the work you're doing. How long before we get to call you doctor? That's our next question.
It's probably going to be this time next year.
Okay, so
in about a year, and I want you guys to know that I am honored, absolutely honored that you guys allowed me the opportunity to serve in this way today.
No, we appreciate you so much. So thanks for joining us, and we'll have all kind of other resources in the show notes, and soon to be doctor. We're going to come back, and it'll be a totally different podcast, because you're going to have your doctorate and be not just a year smarter. I mean, you're going to have all the letters and everything, and we can't wait to talk to you again. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you guys so very much for your time as well.
This podcast has been a collaboration between Parents as Teachers National Center and Strong Fathers, Strong Families, LLC. To learn more, visit us at either www.parentsasteachers.org or www.strongfathers.com. You can also find us on Twitter or Facebook